we finished chapter 30, and I've already completed chapter 31, 32, so we're going to chapter 33, the final chapter of the whole canto. Title is Activities of Kapila, and this morning's verse is text 8. Verses 1 through 8 is a section. It's Devahuti's prayers, summarizing what she has received from Kapila Dev and her appreciation for him. This verse 8 is the final of her prayers. Then he replies, summarizing everything. This verse sounds very much like the verses that we covered yesterday evening at the Boston Temple. That's the verses just after the Chaturshloki verses. Param Brahma, Param Dhamma, Pavitram, Paramam Bhavam, Purusham, Shashvatam, Divyam. Arjuna is calling out Krishna's glories. In this verse, Devahuti is calling out Lord Kapila's glories. The rasa is different. One is friend and friend, and here is mother and son. But leaving rasa aside, it's Kapila's position and the benefit that one derives from understanding his position, what you do when you understand his position. Just before we begin, the previous verse, text 7, is often quoted verse. Aho bhata sva pacho to gariyan yaj jivagre vartate namatubhyam. The glorious position of devotional service and beginning with the chanting of Krishna's name is such that svapacha means dog eater. Even when one is born in a family of dog eaters, one is glorious. If one chants the Nama Tubhyam, the holy name, Jivagre, the tip of the tongue, is found Nama. And then the converse, even if one is so exalted by birth and knowledge and austerities and sacrifices and all good things, if they don't chant the holy name, or if they're not engaged in service to the Supreme Lord, they're not in the same standard. And by the simple activity of chanting, all other things are fulfilled. So text 8 is her conclusion. Tam tvam aham brahma parama pumam sam. I believe, my Lord, that you are Lord Vishnu himself. Under the name of Kapila. And you are the supreme personality of Godhead, the supreme Brahman. The saints and sages, being freed from the disturbance of the senses and mind, meditate upon you. For by your mercy only can one become free from the clutches of the three modes of material nature. At the time of dissolution, all the Vedas are sustained in you only. Veda Garbham. Veda Garbham. The repository of the Vedas. Garbha. means egg or womb or the repository, the place where the Vedas take shelter. Of course, the Vedas take shelter in him before creation, during cosmic manifestation, and after annihilation. Vedas are not temporary, and the Supreme Lord is not temporary. Creation comes, and with creation comes the Vedas, according to Bhagavad Gita. So by connecting with the Vedas, one connects with the Supreme Lord. Living one's life according to the codes of Dharma found within the Vedas, you're connecting with the Supreme Lord that way. A very simple visual example. Supposing I wanted to shake hands with somebody in the back of the room. My arm isn't long enough, and nor is theirs. But supposing some kind of extension, then put a glove on the end of the extension and go like that. You're not literally shaking hands with the other person, but in effect, the Vedas are extensions, non-different extensions from the Supreme Lord. They Veda Garbham, he's the shelter and the repository of them. So we connect with the Supreme Lord through the Vedas. So it's a great misfortune when the Vedas are neglected, or to speak of rejected, as Buddha rejected the Vedas, leaving people like in a ship in the ocean without a rudder and without a captain. It's a dangerous situation. Fortunately, Buddha's an incarnation, so people who take shelter of Buddha get the shelter of the personality of Godhead minus the Vedas, but then activities can become whimsical. And if something can become whimsical, it often happens. Just an example of that, anecdotal example, but Sri Radhika in St. Louis is part of she does homeschooling with her two boys, and she's part of a collective homeschooling group from different backgrounds. So one of the things that this collective homeschooling group does from time to time, collectively, they go to this place of worship and that place of worship and another place of worship to hear from and appreciate, you know, the diversity of views, so that their children can appreciate diversity of views. Only sometimes it doesn't lead exactly to appreciation. Because she said that recently they had gone to a Buddhist monastery, and the chief Buddhist priest was the one addressing them. And the first thing he said is, "I just want to make one thing very clear. We're not vegetarian." I mean, how do you get there? that's the lead point. How do you know, your main religious principle is ahimsa and we're not vegetarian? How do you put it together? So you reject the Vedas and you have a problem. Even if you're, you know, a follower of Buddha, there's no standard. So without more on that point. Purport by Srila Prabhupada. Devahuti, the mother of Kapila, instead of prolonging her prayers, summarized that Lord Kapila was none other than Lord Vishnu, and since she was a woman, it was not possible for her to worship him properly simply by prayer. It was her intention that the Lord be satisfied. The word pratyak is significant. In yoga practice, the eight divisions are yama, niyama, asana, pranayama, pratyahara. It's number five. Dharana, dhyana, and samadhi. Pratyahara. You know what that is? Pratyahara? You know what pranayama is? Breath control? Pranayama. You've heard of that before? No. You've heard of that one before? Pranayama. When people go to take yoga classes, generally they do asanas or different postures. And these days, now it's becoming popular, that they'll also teach something to do with pranayama. Pranayama is prana, life air. Controlling the life air. Different procedures for Prabhupada called it drilling the respiratory system. And then the next one in sequence, so yama, niyama, the do's and the don'ts. Asana, sitting postures. Pranayama, breathing exercise. And then pratyahara. Here, pratyahara in this verse becomes pratyak. Pratyahara means to wind up the activities of the senses, to withdraw the senses. It doesn't mean your arms go into your body and your eyes go back into your head and your tongue goes down your throat or something. It doesn't mean that. It means the subtle senses in day-to-day life are extended, and the medium of their extending is the instrument, the sense of touch and the sense of sight and the sense of hearing. So the subtle sense is withdrawn. It's a state, it is a discipline, it's the fifth stage. And a nice example of that is Grandfather Bhishma. Grandfather Bhishma. So Grandfather Bhishma was lying on the bed of arrows, and he was instructing Yudhisthira. And then the sun started to move in the northerly direction, meaning Makara Sankranti, January 14th. The sun, that from summer to winter, moving down, 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 down. In relation to the northern hemisphere, it's down. And then it starts moving in the northerly direction. So according to 8th chapter Bhagavad Gita, that's an auspicious time or an ideal time for yogis to go to Vaikuntha and leave their body when the sun starts to move in the northerly direction. So as the sun started to move in the northern direction, Grandfather Bhishma stopped speaking and he did the Pratyahara program. He withdrew his senses, consolidating the tendency of the voice to speak and the eyes to see and the ears to hear and the sense of touch to feel and the smell to smell. He just withdrew the senses. And then dhyana, dharana, samadhi, the concentration of the mind completely upon the personality of Godhead. So that's what's being said here. Pratyahara means to wind up the activities of the senses. The level of realization of the Supreme Lord, evidenced by Devahuti, is possible when one is able to withdraw the senses from material activities. So she's just having a an exchange of speaking and hearing with her son, who she understands as Lord Vishnu. And as Lord Vishnu, one who fixes their mind upon him, or say it differently, in order to fix one's mind upon him, there is something before the Dhyana Dharana Samadhi, there has to be this withdrawal of the senses. Withdrawal of the senses from material activity. That's the key. Pratyak Shrotasi Atmani. It means turning, the mind turns inward. The saints and sages, being freed from the disturbance of the senses and mind, meditate upon you. They can meditate upon, the sages and saints can meditate upon the Supreme Lord because they master this pratyahara. They're able to sit and be happy, or move about and be happy, because their interest is not in extending the senses to find some happiness outside, some sensation, one of the senses, hearing or smelling or tasting or touching or seeing. They're content within. And in that state of meditation, they have the capacity to realize the personality of Godhead, see the personality of Godhead, interact with the personality of Godhead within. It's like the Brihat Bhagavatamrita description of Tapaloka. The residents of Tapaloka are sannyasis and brahmacharis, and they have the capacity in their trance of meditation to see the Supreme Lord and interact with the Supreme Lord from within. So they like it. They're meditation fans. She's saying that the sages and saints that have this pratyahara, the Sanskrit here is pratyak shrotasi atmani, their mind and senses are turned inward instead of outward. You're the object of their meditation. They're not turning their attention outward, mind and senses. They're turning inward, and their meditation is upon you. And as a result, they do become free from the modes of nature. Now remember the question from the very beginning, so many chapters ago, 8 chapters ago. How do I become free from undue affinity for family life? Here it is. Control the mind and senses, turn them inward, and focus upon the personality of Godhead. But it doesn't mean, well, you have to give up, you know, your activities. It's not Bhagavad Gita's message. It's not Kapila's message. Although, interestingly enough, this is Satya Yuga. And what's the primary means for achieving spiritual perfection in Satya Yuga?
Fire sacrifice.
No.
Meditation.
Yes. So he's teaching a process of meditation. And that process of meditation, just review, it leads to focusing upon the Supersoul and then engaging in activities of service as you go about your day-to-day life, serving Supersoul. Serving the Supreme Lord Vishnu. Bhakti. Because what's bhakti? Rishikena Rishikesha Sevanam. Rishikesha Sevanam. You use your senses in service of the master of the senses. So how do you do the Pratyahara program when you do serve this master of the senses with the senses? You do that not for material purpose, you do for a spiritual purpose, and otherwise the mind is focused upon the personality of Godhead. In simple language of Bhagavad Gita, perform your prescribed duty and always think of me. Perform your prescribed duty means for Vishnu. Prescribed duty is Yajna Vai Vishnu. Daivi Varnashram. You do your prescribed duty for the satisfaction of Vishnu. So there's this transition thing that we call dovetail. Well, I like music. Hey, the Krishna people have music. Let's do music for Krishna, right? Okay. So it's the main mentality in participating in kirtan for many people, and especially in the beginning, is the musicality of it. I was noticing in the audience yesterday, there were two girls sitting next to each other that didn't know the words of Jai Radha Madhava. So I figured out, they're new. And so initially they're kind of looking around like, what's going on? And then after some time, you know, they started tapping their leg. And, you know, the musicality was getting to them. So, you know, that's natural. That's the first area of interest, not, you know, the words and meditating on the meaning of the words and becoming absorbed in the mood of Vrindavan. I mean, they're not going to go there right away. So initially it's dovetail. Oh, I like music. There's music. Or, you know, I like eating. Have good food. I'm glad to come. In many temples, I'm sure the Boston Temple is not an exception because I've seen it, a lot of people know when prasadam is served. So there's maximum attendance when it's prasadam time. And then they also get Didi Darshan, but, you know, prasadam time. So that's a dovetail. But the pratyak shrotasya atmani, where the mind and the senses are turned inward, that's the subtle sense. You can engage the external sense, you know, the seeing, but the internal sense of seeing is seeing in relation to Vishnu. There's statements that explain it very nicely or articulate it very nicely. They don't just see the world as they used to see the world or as ordinary people see the world. They see Vishnu everywhere. Now, what does that mean? They see Vishnu everywhere. Like they don't see the tree, they see Vishnu. They see the tree, but they see in relation to Vishnu. And so their senses are engaged externally in activities of worship. Yad karoshi, yad asnasi, yad jahosi, dadasi, yad tapasyasi, konteya, tat kurashva, madarpanam. Madarpanam means it's a gesture of worship, an extension of worship, the external. Daivi varnashram, you do things for Krishna. And the internal, this is, you know, Satya Yuga, it's these eightfold pratyahara, then leading to Dhyan Dharana Samadhi. Then they can understand the personality of God, and he becomes known that way. When one can control the mind and senses, that means not engage them in material activity. The level of realization of the Supreme Lord is evidenced by Devahuti. Excuse me. The level of realization of the Supreme Lord evidenced by Devahuti is possible when one is able to withdraw the senses from material activities. When one is engaged in devotional service, there is no scope for his senses to be engaged otherwise. In such full Krishna consciousness, one can understand the Supreme Lord as he is. That's the conclusion of what we're supposed to understand from these, actually it's nine chapters. The process of devotional service has these two elements, what your body does and what the internal functions do. And one who has that capacity to have your internal functions focused upon, turned inward and focused upon the person for whom you're serving, that's devotion. There's the mechanical description, and there's the devotional description. It's being attracted to the personality of Godhead with the desire to be in his service. And then the senses do what they do, and for service to Krishna or Vishnu, and not otherwise. Then that's protection. We can be in the world and not of the world, under Krishna's protection. So she's speaking, just a summary, she's speaking to Kapila that you are that Lord Vishnu. I mean, I'm your mother, but not really. You're Lord Vishnu. You've appeared as my son, but you are that person who great yogis and saints fix their mind upon and become free from the modes of nature. We can't become free from the modes of nature otherwise. You can try. There may be good intention. At the same time, while there's good intention, there's also something else going on. There's rebellion against Vishnu. But I don't want to meditate on Vishnu. I want to do it my own way. I want to be spiritual my own way. And it's aversion to the personality of Godhead. Well, you know, one's intentions may appear to be quite sincere. And you can't become free from the modes of nature otherwise. Now there's the process of transcendental in Rishabhdev's teachings, fifth canto, first five, six verses are core verses of Rishabhdev's teachings to his 100 sons. And one of the verses he speaks is Mahatsevam Dvaram Ahur Vimuktes. Mahatsevam, serving the great souls, Mahatsevam Dvaram. Dvara means gate. Ahur Vimuktes. One achieves the stage of liberation, mukti, by Mahatsevam, serving the great souls. In the purport, very liberally, Prabhupada says, there are two classes of transcendentalists, the devotees and the impersonalists. And that stage of becoming free from, because mukti just means neutral. In its basic sense, it's no longer under the influence of the modes of nature and karma. So the modes of nature and karma can be neutralized by either impersonalism or personalism. That is to say, if one can actually become Brahman realized, like Shukadeva Goswami was Brahman realized, he wasn't influenced by passion or ignorance or even goodness. Brahman realized position and associate with Shukadeva Goswami in that condition, and one can also become in that neutral position. However, it's a temporary situation, and the permanent situation is take shelter of the personality of Godhead. So that's what she's saying. She's now declaring the answer to the question that she asked 9 chapters ago. Meditation, fixing the mind upon the personality of Godhead. Thus one can become free from the modes of nature and attain the supreme abode. It's a nice, expanded explanation of essential verses or essential messages found in Bhagavad Gita. You'll be undergraduate and graduate study. Bhagavatam is the graduate study. The messages are absolutely correct in Bhagavad Gita. Understanding them more completely, Srimad Bhagavatam is there. Wonderful literature. End with that, see if there's any discussion. Yes.
Maharaj, I was just thinking of the students in the universities. So, I've been hearing from you how your experience was in the Brandeis, the meaning of descending mercy, even if it is heard, how much the student may get out of it, what does it mean, still unclear.
Brandeis?
Yeah, no, I was referring to what you shared about an interaction with a student in Brandeis.
Okay, the discussion afterwards.
Yes.
Okay.
And then bringing to the context of what I have seen in the university, like the students, they come out of high school and now they're in the university with like tons of freedom.
Yeah.
It's like a volcanic eruption of freedom, and they have observed that, you know, they just want to relish that freedom without being washed over by anybody who's, you know, even elder to them. So there's a just... I was just thinking, like, what is even like basic qualities like responsibility, discipline, is sometimes very challenging to incorporate in their life or in their at least study environment when the whole suppression that they had felt when they were younger. It just comes out, you know, when they're in a university setting where they're not with their parents.
So not always. It's not always like that. That the opportunity is like that, but it's not always like that. Keep going. What's your question?
So the and I've seen graduate level students as well, like in my class. I feel that probably some age, like when somebody's of an elder age, they're more receptive, they're more responsible. Maybe their financial situation brings them to that position or what. But I was just thinking how to, like, is there any sugar-coated way of giving a descending, you know, like a dose of descending mercy in that environment in these two different set of students?
I'm confused by your question. Aside from student life, just in principle, how to give, using the word that you use, descending mercy, how to give Krishna's mercy to people. Doesn't matter, you know, what the stage of life is. Childhood, teenage, college age, graduate school, you know, etc., etc., keep going. Is there a sugar-coated way to give Krishna's mercy to people? Well, so much depends upon the person. Some persons like it this way and some persons like it that way. The most important principle is the topic that Yubi chose, and I spoke about, was becoming a true leader. So to become a true leader, the message was relationships. And relationships are based upon trust. So the basis of a trusting relationship is being trustworthy. So my response to your question is, just be trustworthy. And then, depending upon the person and their stage of wherever they're at, extend Krishna's mercy in a way that makes sense, that they can accept. They can accept the guidance and the wisdom and go from where they are to the next thing and feel, wow, that felt good. So just sustaining and maintaining that relationship of trust. But it starts with being trustworthy. The sugar coating is just be a genuinely trustworthy person, and then the magic can happen, or the chemistry can happen, or the movement can happen. And then so much depends upon, you know, the particulars depends upon the person and the situation, and different times that one person can be in this situation, that situation, or the situation. Their circumstances of life change. And so the application is going to change depending upon what they're passing through.
My particular, I took the university example, is that they are very anti-authority in that phase of their life.
Not necessarily, though. I mean, that's a generalization, that's not necessarily the fact. Yes, commonly, but not necessarily. And the sense of freedom, or even take it further, rebellion towards authority, has a lot to do with they don't see authority that they find worthy. So I'm going to go my own way. I mean, aside from the feeling the sense of freedom, unfettered freedom. Some persons, you know, don't really want that. And they know they don't really want that, but they, you know, Where's their shelter? No, it depends. I'm reluctant to make that sweeping generalization. So if that's in the case where there is this unfettered freedom spirit, then the answer doesn't change. Just be available as a person who is trustworthy. You're not judging, you're not controlling, you're not manipulating, you're not this thing, that thing. You're just being. And someone that can recognize, wow, there's somebody that's not manipulating, controlling, and judging. They're just, I like what I see. Then, channel opens. The receiving channel opens. And there's some signal that says that. Depending on the person, their broadcaster system, they'll let you know. I'm ready to receive.
Hare Krishna Maharaj. There's a question about transmigration, which we covered yesterday or day before. If the souls are continuously changing bodies, are transmigrating one from one body to other, who resides in the Pitur Loka? Can you elaborate something about that?
It's a mystery. There's living entities that go from this place to that place, and they stay in that place. But exactly where that place is and what's it like, and it's a bit of a mystery. I've researched it and have been unable to find much at all, and asked other scholarly people and shrugged their shoulders. So that's the answer is the question of what's up there, what goes on there. And who goes there instead of some other species in the normal routine? Who goes there? I don't get much of an answer. Some go there. I don't have much to say about it because I haven't found much from scripture that explains it. It's a place where some living entities go. Pitur Loka. It's not, at least my understanding is, it's not that all ancestors go there. In other words, there may very well be other ancestors that go to heavenly planets, or this place, or that place, or a lower planet, or whatever, or human form, or whatever. Ancestors, they go to those next life form, and some go to that place, Pitur Loka. And who goes there? What just determines who goes there and who doesn't? No information.
So, Maharaj, does it come under the spiritual planets?
No, it's not. It's a material place.
You very nicely explained at Brandeis University how transcending the modes of material nature essentially means not to be influenced by the modes, but actually be in a position to utilize them in Krishna's service. I've also heard from you in different lectures, like how you say that frame your life in the mode of goodness. So does that statement tend to indicate that you are controlled by the mode of goodness, or you are in a position to utilize goodness, which is transcendental goodness?
Well, initially it's controlled by goodness, by choice. I lead my life in such a way that my choices go in the direction of goodness. Transcendence comes later. Depending upon circumstance, one can progressively enter into transcendence.
Another thought that I was having when you were describing is how inside the mind to have the absorption.
Mind and senses.
Mind and senses. In the context of Premanjana Chuvita Bhakti Vilochinena, that verse when you were discussing in Nama Samhita, referring to Bhaktisiddhanta Saraswati Thakur's purport, mentioned that salve of love essentially refers to the spiritual form of the living entity through which one is situated in the loving disposition. And then when that exchange happens, then that is pure platform of devotional service. And here we are talking about at the mind level or subtle body level. I just wanted to see if there's anything.
I'm waiting. I'm waiting. You want to see if there's anything?
Anything that you would like to share as a distinction between the two points, like here.
It's just stages. That's all. That's the distinction. We practice, then become spontaneous, then become situated in love. In the spontaneous stage, you don't need practice. In the stage of love, spontaneous is already included. So it's the differentiation between the two is the stage of spiritual evolution. Yeah. You gotta speak a little louder.
Why don't you come here?
She likes being there.
Okay.
Speak louder.
At the time of death, if you think about unconscious object, would you be that object next?
No. You can't become a table. But you can be conscious of the table, and depending upon how you regard the table or the inanimate object, that's the consciousness that determines the next life form. You could become a person that owns the table. You could become a cockroach that climbs around the table. So it's the consciousness is also along with the object that you're thinking about. Yes? Yes?
Hey, Krishna. Yesterday at the temple, Wednesday feast lecture, one thing you said that stayed with me was, what you think of, you go there. Like you mentioned, you think of Boston, you are in Boston. And when you think of, say, Vaikuntha or something, you're there. And then I was reading chapter 30 after the Tuesday morning class. And in that, there are descriptions like when you're in those Naraka Logas.
When you're where?
When you're in the hellish planets.
Okay.
Your subtle body is tied, and sometimes you're eating your own flesh. And sometimes other people are eating your flesh and so on. So I was just, those two, I was trying to connect. Who thinks of those things to go to that level?
Pretty dark. Pretty dark. It's the understanding that I have is these things are happening on a subtle level. When the Yamadutas come, they take the subtle body, with subtle ropes to the abode of Yamaraj. Yamaraj gives the sentence that you go to such and such place. It's still the subtle body. So it's in the subtle body that these things are happening. And then after enormous suffering in the subtle body, because that's where suffering takes place, one gets a body in the proper species to match guna and karma. It could be an insect, it could be a bird, it could be a dog, according to guna and karma. But first is that hellish suffering, which is subtle. That's my understanding. You don't yet have the next gross body. In other words, it passes like a flash, but it seems like a lifetime. That's what it feels like, but it's a moment. And then the next body. Like Prabhupada gives this example in a dream. Supposing in a dream, your dream that you see your head being chopped off. Now, the seeing part of the body is in the head. You can't see the head get chopped off. So to see in a dream your head get chopped off, it's on a subtle plane. And it gets, you know, even to describe it gets subtle, because the seat of consciousness is the soul. And then there's the instruments, and then there's the mind that receives the sensory data from the senses. But this is all within the mind. You're the seer, but you're the one that's dreaming whatever you're seeing in the dream. It's you know, abstract and abstract and further abstract. The suffering in the hellish planets is on the subtle plane, is my understanding. So your question was not that. Your question was, you know, how did you get that low? You know, it's you know, sinful activities. Defiance of the personality of Godhead.
Seems very cruel, Maharaj, to be honest. Like,
well, the behaviors that lead to that situation, that's the cruelty, and one is reaping the consequence of that cruelty. I'm just reading yesterday from Ramayana, and when Ravana, he had defeated his brother Kubera and stole from him his Pushpaka Vimana. So he was zooming around checking out things, and one of the places he wanted to go to was as far north as he could go, and he bumped into Kailash, and the Pushpaka wouldn't go further. So he got off the Pushpaka and was looking around, and there was Nandi. And, you know, Nandi said, "You can leave now. This is the abode of Lord Shiva. You don't have qualification to enter." So he said something, Ravana said some reply, "Who's Lord Shiva anyway?" And Nandi had some kind of a weapon and said, "With this weapon I should kill you, but actually you've already killed yourself by your sinful activities, so I'm not going to waste my time." So you say unfair, but you know, the sinful activities were the cause. Sadasa Yoni Janmasu, chapter 13, Bhagavad Gita, were the cause of our own misfortune. You can say it's not fair. I heard somebody else at Brandeis say the same thing. That girl. Not fair. I'm not doing well this year, so it's not fair. I'm still trying, but I'm not getting the results, so it's not fair. We reap the we're responsible for our own activities that are free will choices. And that's fair. You may not like the consequences. The consequences are there to help you make the right choices instead of the wrong ones. Just like I said yesterday morning in the class about the adverse fruit of activity, it's not a scare tactic, it's the consequences of. If you take this valuable human form of life and misuse it, there's consequences. You have something? Go ahead.
Like, what if you die when you were sleeping or something? What would
it's not, it happens. But the mind is active when you're sleeping. Have you noticed? Mm-hmm. Sometimes you've noticed when you just dream and things like that. So, you know, it's two things. The mind is somewhere and the mode of ignorance is predominant. At least in terms of the physical body, the mode of ignorance is predominant. You're sleeping. And the thoughts of the mind will go to what you're most attached to, and that's going to carry the soul to the next body. That's what happens. So your question was, what happens? According to the modes of nature and according to what your mind is fixed on. That's where you go. Supposing you were Krishna conscious, just close your eyes and imagine being Krishna conscious and you're sleeping. Your thoughts are going to be with Krishna because you're Krishna conscious. You go to Krishna. Supposing you're not Krishna conscious, depends on guna and karma. And where your mind is fixed on, it's going to determine where you go. Is that okay? Yes.
Maharaj, we are spirit soul, we are not our mind. However, the only way to transcend the three modes of material nature is to focus our mind on the Shri. So, does that mean in this lifetime we can spiritualize our mind and then their mind will go with us to the spiritual world?
Yes.
But in scripture it said, also says, I think I got it. The material mind.
You got it.
But it's not possible. But this material body will always stay with us until the moment of death.
Yes.
So,
well, that's what death means, you leave the body. So the material body will stay with you until you leave the body. However, let's just think of Srila Prabhupada. And he had a material body that he left, but even when he was within his material body, whatever he touched became spiritualized just because his body was spiritualized. A nice example is a copper wire. This one lying on the floor is nothing, but connected to the electric outlet, it's electricity. It carries electricity. It acts like electricity, although it's just a copper wire. Similarly, or an iron rod that's in fire acts like fire, although it's an iron rod. Similarly, a body and a mind that's absorbed in the fire of devotional service, it acts in a spiritual way. Just, you know, the touch of the body of a transcendentalist. It's not like you get an electric shock, but there's spiritual benefit. And that's how it works, you know, how being in the material world, spiritualizing things of this world.
The question I have is, we say the purest of the pure can reach Krishna, and but
Krishna is the purest of pure. those who are in contact with the purest of pure become pure, and they can reach Krishna.
But we also hear that serving Krishna, there's no limit to it. It's how much ever do, it's still not in just enough to serve Krishna. So, in with these two in perspective, so where is that limit to say, okay, this is the amount of purification that you need?
Oh, that's a silly question. The premise of your question is mistaken, and the conclusion of your question is mistaken. I'll correct it. Pure means that there isn't an interest other than Krishna. There are degrees of that purity, but purity means so perfect, more perfect, most perfect, a kind of idea. Or using Brihat Bhagavatamrita as an example, each of the persons that Narada encounters, they're perfect, 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 perfect. So what's the standard of perfect? If there's no interest other than Krishna. And then there's degrees of that. So what's the standard? Perfect or pure is no other interest. That's the standard, and we're not there. But we're cultivating that. One who is cultivating that properly will get there. And why? Because the contact is with the purest of the pure. Then we become pure. Okay, looks like we're finished.